Hi, and welcome to Lament Configuration, a podcast about the shit that makes us sad. I'm horror author and film critic Gretchen Felker-Martin, and with me is my illustrious co-host,
Julia Graffaire. I'm a graphic novelist.
And that's all.
That's all. Just going to let it hang there and wait for you to jump in. Or give me a new and better title.
I mean, there's so many things that you are. You're, for instance, one of the most inventive and interesting bakers I've ever seen. The, like, that fungus cake you made is incredible. I think about it all the time.
Oh, yeah. That was like a bûche de Noël. I made a bunch of marzipan mushrooms for it.
Yeah, it was beautiful. Just exquisite. So today we are doing listener questions. And how do you feel about just like jumping right in?
Yeah, let's do it. They better be good.
Yeah. And if they're not, you'll hear about it.
You're all fired.
I don't know what we could actually do.
Make the podcast worse.
This one comes from Scary Stories. What horror tropes and or conventions scare you most and why?
Distorted voices. Scary radio talking to you.
That's very scary.
Definitely my favorite. That just like gets me every time.
The idea that the world is paying attention to you is very frightening. I feel like mine are very like prey animal basic. Like when there's an empty door in the background of a shot, I'm like, fuck, I hate this. I would hate to be in this situation. Like the ghost story haunted house basics always get me. Doors swinging open, people not looking behind them, lights going out. I was in a family with a lot of pranksters, which is like the New England version of asshole.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I got locked in the basement and had the lights turned off on me.
Oh, God.
Got thrown in closets and locked in. And mostly just a lot of, like, being shut in a space I didn't want to be in.
That's awful.
Yeah, I guess it is. but all that stuff is very visceral for me. I get really freaked out.
I can't deal with needles, but that's not really, like, it's not that it's a horror thing that works on me so much as that it just makes me faint. Like, it just makes my brain short circuit.
Yeah.
I also faint in real life. When I get shots and stuff, I faint often also. I get it from my dad. I hope he doesn't mind me saying that. He'll never listen to this. And any movie that has, like, something with needles or veins or not all gore, but, like, certain types of gore will just knock me right out. So those are very effective on me, but not in a way that I like or that is useful for me as a consumer of art. But so like The Exorcist, for example, there's a scene early on where she is having a procedure done to her at the hospital that I stopped saying to myself, like, oh, I can handle this. I know what's going to happen. I'm out cold every time. It's very bad.
Yeah. All right, we watched that together a couple of years ago, and you were just boom, down.
Yep. It's embarrassing. I know nobody really minds, but it's...
I get that, though. It's, like, it's humiliating to feel weak.
And it's, like if somebody is drawing blood, sometimes they'll be like, it's okay, it's not gonna hurt, there's nothing to be scared of, and I'm like, no, I know.
Right, it's just like, there's some doesn't fucking matter. Crimp in my fight-or-flight response.
Yeah. I'm just going to lie down and let the porcupine cheat me.
I'm like when I get like an injury on my hands.
Hmm.
Or a couple of times I had a cyst lanced at the doctor's once and I went down like a ton of bricks.
Oof.
As a kid, I was carving tiles as part of a big class.
Oh, I already know where this is going.
The knife slipped and I cut my hand open and then cracked my head on the edge of the desk as I immediately fainted.
Mm-hmm. That's a great 1-2 punch.
Yeah, good stuff.
Back to horror tropes. I love a haunted house. I love really anything where like the location where a terrible thing happened becomes contaminated by the lingering presence of that suffering. That's really fascinating to me and very creepy.
Yeah, that's something that I think about a lot. an ex of mine and I used to talk about how there's a way that a space can sort of absorb toxicity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like they had these roommates who moved out right before they moved into the apartment where they live now, or maybe it was the one before that, who had been like very codependent, had spent all their time in their room and had like gotten into screaming matches and stuff in there. And when they moved in, there were like, you know, holes that one of them had punched in the wall and just like the worst juju you can imagine in the air.
Mm.
I feel like everyone has that experience, and it's nothing mystical. It's just like your brain has formed these associations and it recognizes the signs and signifiers around it.
I used to have a boss when I was in college who her husband was a Reiki practitioner, and she told me that he would buy flowers every week for his office, and if he had a bad week, then the flowers would wilt sooner.
That seems untrue.
It seems unlikely, but I still love it as an image.
Yeah, it's nice to think about.
What are the practical applications of that? Like, if flowers responded to bad vibes, how could that be? Could you use that to detect bad vibes, like a canary in a coal mine? Like, well, what if you just made friends with somebody and then you were like, oh, I'm just going to bring this bouquet of flowers over?
If you wouldn't mind setting up a camera and sending me a time lapse of the next 4 days.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, you could use it as a vibe detector, even if it is kind of clunky. You could also use it commercially, like to keep flowers fresh longer.
Ooh. Yeah, like instead of one of those little packets of chemicals that comes with a bouquet, right. You could also have, I don't know what, like a Don't Worry, Be Happy on a CD that comes with it. This is, I guess it's pretty similar to that thing about the water that likes to be told, I love you or whatever.
Oh, God. I've heard that so many times in so many different variations from so many different people.
So bogus.
It's completely ridiculous. So when I was a kid, my mother made my sibling and I go to a naturopath instead of a real doctor.
Mm.
And she explained that water harmonics thing to me, and at 9, ooh, I was like, that is fake.
That sucks so much when you're a kid and an adult tells you some shit and you're just like, I know that you are either lying or stupid and there's nothing I can do about it.
Right. Like, this woman is still going to have total power over me and can like put me on a diet and tell my mother whatever she wants about my health and my body. And I know for a fact she's a fucking moron.
When Frank was about 7, maybe 8, I took him to a new therapist, and after a couple of sessions, he was like, I don't think I like her. And I was like, how come? And he was like, well, she told us that thing about how you only use 10% of your brain. And I know that's not true. So I don't think she knows what she's talking about. And I just had to be like, fair enough.
Yep.
I mean, I was like, well, you know, that's kind of a thing that people say. And she probably had lots of other stuff that she knows that's not bullshit, but his trust in her was too damaged by that. And I was like, you know, there's other therapists. It's fine.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, that's like half of what you and I have ever talked about regarding our own therapists. It's like, this person is not smart enough to handle my mental health.
Yeah. That's a hard thing to commit to the airwaves.
We can edit that out.
But it's hard to realize that moment when you realize that you're smarter than your therapist is
right.
Pretty disappointing.
Yeah, it is. I feel like, I mean, we've talked about this before, but so many therapists are basically just going to give you affirmations, which is useless. Right. There's just no point. Not for people who have that in their life and are looking to work on things that are more nuanced. You know, I don't want to be told that everything I'm doing is good and I'm good for doing it.
I don't trust people who say nice things to me. I just don't like it. If somebody pays me a compliment, then I immediately turn it into an insult in my brain, which is not useful to me in any way. But it makes it hard for me to trust somebody who's just going to, like, affirm me.
Right. And there has to be other proof of, like, honesty and integrity.
Yeah. If it's somebody I trust, maybe. If it's you or Sean or Franklin, then, you know.
Right. We're not going to your ass.
But what makes me, you know, like, if somebody tells me that I'm a bad person or that I did something gross, then I'm like, oh, yeah, this person gets me.
Yeah, yeah, we've talked about this before. It's just like
we've having... talked about everything before. Stop saying that.
That's very true. But there is something really gratifying about someone accidentally affirming the deeply held things that you believe about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, like, you're a sack of shit with no redeeming values is pretty high on the list for people who've been through a lot of trauma and have clinical
There's
depression.
There's something very comforting in that.
Yeah, there is. And I mean, it's hard. It's very hard to stop being depressed every day of your life. Not just because, like, you know, life is a challenge and managing your mental health is very difficult and fraught, especially in our terrible hell world, but because depression is very comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Like, all that you have to do in life is get stressed and miserable to the point where you have a breakdown. And then you're good for like another 1 to 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
And you can just keep oozing your way through existence.
Yeah, it sucks when you like get less depressed and then you have to think about like long-term stuff.
Right. All of a sudden, you know, loans matter and you have to think about what you're going to eat next week.
Mm-hmm.
Garbage. Awful.
You have to go to the dentist because you're not planning to kill yourself anymore.
Right.
Very inconvenient.
It really is. It's tedious.
Mm-hmm. There's so much tedious bureaucracy involved in just maintaining a life in the society that we live in. There's taxes, and you're supposed to go to the doctor every 6 months or the dentist every 6 months. And you're supposed to, you know, you have all these different bills you're supposed to pay, and you have to buy groceries. You have to count calories. I mean, you don't have to, but like, there's so much stuff to keep track of and be aware of all the time. And I don't understand how people do it. I am constantly forgetting stuff that I should be doing. Like just the other day, I had an appointment, like a phone appointment at 1:45. And all day long, I was like, I put it on the calendar. I was like, yep, 1:45. And then at like noon, I think I was probably like writing something that I was really hype about. And so I just kept working on it, and my phone was in the other room. And then at 2:00, I was like, oh, shit. Like,
right.
I took my eye off the prize for a second, and then and now I have to call and like reschedule the appointment, and I guess come up with some kind of explanation for, there's only so many times that you can say to your therapist, like, I'm sorry that I'm so flaky.
What I was going to say, and obviously life is an unending headache and it's mm-hmm. very hard to keep track of anything. But what I was going to say is that another horror trope that really gets me is when like a kid is really going through it in a way that's supposed to evoke an atmosphere of horror, like in The Babadook. That kind of constant, like a child in a lot of stress is extremely upsetting to me.
Mm-hmm.
I also have a really hard time watching animals get hurt.
Mm-hmm. Did you see Dr. Sleep?
I did not.
You know that a kid gets tortured to death in Dr. Sleep.
Oof, that sounds like a lot for me.
Yeah, it's really intense. But I did read something that made me feel better about it, which is that the child, the actor, according to his dad, he had a whole plan, like he had worked out ahead of time how he was going to play this role, and he went in, they shot the scene, it was so intense, you know, it took them like a few hours. And then when they knew that they had gotten it, the actors who were supposed to be playing his attackers were like very shaken up, the way that actors sometimes are after they have to do something terrible as a character. And he just got up and gave a big smile and gave his dad a high five because he knew he nailed it. And he was so pleased with himself for upsetting all these adults.
That's very charming.
And I was like, that rules. Good for him. So knowing that makes me feel a little better.
Yeah, that is
good. Next question.
All right. This comes from Scream. I'm sure you've answered this elsewhere, but it feels apropos for this context. What's your favorite Hellraiser movie, and do you recommend the books?
Two, and yes.
Same. I do love the stop-motion effect of Frank Cotton coming back to life in the first one, and I don't think there's a practical effect that's quite that good in the second one, but the second one is so much more emotionally resonant for me.
Mm-hmm.
Just like the friendship between Kirsty and the mute puzzle-solving girl.
Tiffany, right?
Tiffany, that's it.
That's, we really vibe with that as two fucked up women trying to make sense of hell.
Yes.
With only each other for company.
That's very much the Gretchen and Julia go on the road movie. And speaking of Julia, her whole like story in that movie is so good.
It's very, very good. I know, I've said this many times, but that her hanging around Dr. Chouinard's house with no skin.
Oof.
I've never related to a character more. Just like touching the walls, leaving blood on them.
Punching the mirror, yeah. Extremely relatable.
She's just like, I'm cold.
I love the part where she looks up from the asylum patient that she's just finished looking dry and says, don't be scared of me.
Oh, she's so sexy.
She's incredibly sexy. That actress has such a like strong, striking face.
Mm-hmm.
Just very cool.
Is it the same actress, what's her name, Claire something, playing Julia with no skin?
Yeah, which is pretty cool.
And that just to go back to that sequence too of him putting the bandages on her is very erotic.
Oh my God, yeah. It's so, it reminds me a lot of the scene in Manhunter where Reba touches the sleeping tiger.
Hell yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. the eroticization of something incredibly dangerous.
Yes.
And, you know, he's visibly afraid during that scene, which is also very hot.
Mm-hmm.
I love his discomfort with her.
Yes.
And her total disregard for it.
I mean, I love an evil woman ordering a man around. That's always extremely good to me.
Yeah. That's what's best in life.
She's a queen. That Japanese poster for Hellbound that says, like, Julia, you're beautiful.
Oh, Julia, you're so beautiful. I think I sent you that for your birthday one year.
Yes, you did. I love her so much.
She's perfect. Oh my God. The scenes in the first movie where she's sitting in the bathroom covered in blood and looking just like, what have I gotten myself into? That's all time shit.
Yeah.
As for the books, I like The Hellbound Heart. I prefer the movies, the first two anyway, but The Hellbound Heart is good. Barker's prose is really cool and visceral in a way that the movie is distinct from. So it's worth having the different experience, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't read, I think there are maybe a few other short stories set in that fictional universe that I haven't read. I have read The Scarlet Gospels, which concludes the Cenobite story, and I really do not like it at all.
How come?
I know that Barker is struggling with his health, and the book is really flawed. There's a lot of like dead air in it. It's also one of the most viciously transphobic things I've ever read.
Oh, Clive. Oh, no.
Which is just a real bummer. And it's like not, it's not equivocal.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I mean, on top of that, it's just kind of boring. Just weak. Not up to his standard, which is a real pity.
Well, that's really unfortunate.
Yeah, it made me very sad to read for a lot of reasons.
Sorry for making you criticize the king on record.
He's still my boy. I love him. You know, when you're a fat transsexual, you have to come to grips with the fact that everyone you love hates you.
The whole world will be your enemy. And if they catch you, they will kill you.
And also, I'm
you must
not
catch
fast
you.
At all. And there's only one of me.
Mm-hmm.
I do love Watership Down, though.
Yep, yep. I think it must be tricky as a horror author to... It must be. I'm sure I wouldn't know. Like, you're constantly mining your own all the ugliest parts of yourself through material. You know, you've got your hat powered by sadness.
Right.
And so you're putting all these ugly things about yourself up front. And I think it's almost inevitable that stuff like that is going to come out. I mean, not that you're necessarily going to show yourself to be transphobic, because a lot of people are not. But, like, your ugly prejudices, whatever they are, will become apparent, because that's what your work is about.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth in that. You know, we have talked about everything before. But we have talked a lot about Stephen King and the way he writes about fat bodies, and just like how unbelievably hellish and horrible it is.
Mm-hmm. Right. And didn't you theorize that he might have been a fat child?
I think that was Sean's theory. My personal theory is just that it's very garden variety to be repulsed and afraid about fatness.
I feel like his high-handedness about it is the high-handedness of a person who sees a vice that they themselves feel they've overcome.
Right. The formerly fat.
Yes, exactly.
I can see it. I think that that is a distinct possibility. But my gut tells me that he is just a person who hates fat people, and that there might be no deep reason behind it. You know, I know that a lot of people sort of intellectualize that loathing as like, well, fat people are a drain on the medical system, and we're all paying to keep them alive, and it's immoral, and they're destroying like the communities that they're in.
Is that his?
Well, that's something that crops up. You know, he very much writes fat people as human beings who are eating themselves to death.
It's just lies.
Yeah.
I mean, I know it's like, it's something that people really love to repeat, like it gives them comfort to believe those things, but it's so anti-intellectual.
Yeah, it is. It's very vested in stupidity and cruelty.
Yeah, that's really disappointing.
It is. I mean, I feel like, and of course I'm not a medical doctor, and I do not have in-depth medical knowledge, but I think that a lot of the things that people die of that are attributed to obesity can really be laid at the feet of medical negligence.
Absolutely. Yes. Yes.
I mean,
I think that has actually been shown to be true.
Research bears it out, but
yeah, fat people die from prejudice, not from being fat.
Right. And also we all face like orders of magnitude more stress from our loved ones,
mm-hmm.
who will constantly say things that would be totally unconscionable to say to any other kind of person. It's very difficult to exist when you know that the people who love you also kind of hate you and see you as repulsive.
Right. You're like marked by your body as like, hello, I'm here to be your scapegoat. Like, work out your self-loathing on me.
Right. Barker also
indulges. Barker fucking hates fat people.
He really does. He has like an aesthetic disgust for us.
Mm-hmm.
I really get the feeling that fat people are cockroaches to him.
Yeah. For Barker, I think it's part of his like horror of the mundane. Like, he sees being fat as very square.
Right. And, you know, he's from the UK's sort of mid-80s cruising culture,
mm-hmm.
where fat phobia was extremely intense.
Yeah. It's like, to him, it's a symbol of like bourgeois complacency. And
right. If you're fat, you're just kind of a lump.
Mm-hmm.
It's too bad, because they have such heat when they write about these things, but they have no insight. So you're touching something that could be turned to considerable advantage, that you could mine for something really painful and difficult. And instead, they're flinching at the last second when you would have to like acknowledge that these people are human.
Right. I mean, when you write about fat characters, you are so direct about the way that other characters react to them, sometimes are repulsed by them, about the things in their world that are actively working against them because they're fat. And their own, like, they have self-loathing about it. You don't, like, try to sugarcoat it. I mean, you don't sugarcoat anything. It's not your way. But it makes those moments really so raw and eviscerating in your work. Like, it's very, very painful because you don't pull those punches.
Thank you, like, Julia. I try very hard.
I think you make it as upsetting, as disturbing as it is when they talk about it, but you don't give the comfort of dehumanizing. And it's really powerful.
You know, it took me a long time to get to a place where I felt I could even try to do that. For many, many years, I would not write about a fat person in the same way that I would not write about trans people. And, you know, even after coming out, it was a difficult process of allowing myself to do those things.
Why is that?
I think part of it is self-loathing. And part of it is fear that self-loathing will be perceived, or that I could somehow damage my own credibility or betray that I lack insight or empathy. Mm-hmm. But I think more than anything, it's this sort of ingrown belief that I don't deserve to exist. So how could I possibly make this story about someone like me?
Yeah.
And it's, those are still emotions that I feel when I write. It has not become easy. I'm just better at it.
Me too. Like, there's so much shame that I feel, like, when I am writing things that are very personal to me. Like, a lot of things that I write are about trauma and fears and sorrows that are far from resolved in my mind. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, I'm making other people look at this, and they're going to see it, and they're going to say, oh, that's why she's so whatever. They're going to get some kind of insight into me, and I guess we have just come to embrace that, right? Like, we've dealt with that by leaning into it, by just being like, yes, that's right, we're horrible.
Yeah, you know, there comes a point where you have enough skill and enough confidence that you can just sort of put your shoulder ahead and bowl through it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I kind of make myself, I just force myself to put it down. And there's something exhilarating about that kind of self-disclosure.
There is. It's, you know, there's something almost a little exhibitionist about it.
Yeah, we're literally just flashers in the park.
Right.
With sausages tied to our dicks or whatever. Next question.
Okay. Going off part of the discussion in episode one, do you have any advice for artists who struggle to build conviction and confidence in their own ideas?
Probably.
It's a trick. It's just a trick you play on yourself until it's real.
Yeah, you really just have to fake it, I think. When I was a baby artist, just after graduating, I spent a lot of time psyching myself up. I've been an introvert all my life, and at some point I realized that being an artist is a social job, so I was going to have to at least pretend to be an extrovert, pretend to be excited to meet strangers and talk to them and charm them. And now I just do. I'm relatively extroverted now for a cartoonist, which is not saying a lot. I was really obnoxious. I remember, like, going to a gallery that I really admired in Seattle and, like, demanding to speak to the curator so that I could show my work to him. There was, like, a group show that a bunch of my friends were in that I wasn't invited to, and I just sent something in as if I had been invited. And they put it in the show. They emailed me. They were like, this is not an open call show. We didn't invite you, but the piece is good, so we're hanging it. And I am a normal person who lives in a society. Like, I felt shame and fear to do weird things like this, but I was also like, I don't know, this would have been in, when did I graduate college? 2004. I'm thinking about, like, Egon Schiele or Anakin Skywalker or something. I'm like, what would a guy my age who is high on the fumes of his own superiority, how would he sell himself?
Right. He would walk in the door.
That. Yeah.
And say, it's me, Julia Graffair, and I demand to be heard and witnessed.
Yes. So that's what I did. And I was just faking it. But, okay, so the other day, Matthew Perpetua, our friend who is a blogger and podcaster about music, asked on Twitter, what is the worst advice in lyrics that you have heard? Advice, specifically. And for me, it was that every time I'm at a convention, I have to, like, I think I'm not supposed to count my money when I'm sitting at the table. I know it's a different kind of table. I don't know why this has stuck with me, but like, I'm telling myself this. And at some point, it might have been Hazel, actually, who told me that they didn't think it was, that it's actually like good to let people know that you're successful. I had some kind of idea like, oh, well, people are going to see that like I have this wad of bills and they're going to be like, oh, she doesn't need more customers. And they were like, no, they're going to see that you're really popular and they're going to want to get in on it. And Matthew said the same thing. He said like, well, people want to join the winning team. Mm-hmm. If you act like you're the shit, then people will want to get in on it if you can be convincing.
Right. If your shit is good or eventually gets good enough, then that and the performance of confidence are enough.
Mm-hmm. And now I just am confident.
Right. Like, this is something that I learned from you, largely. Basically through that exact same advice. Like, well, just pretend you have every right.
Uh-huh. Oh, another one was James Bond. Sometimes I would walk in and pretend I was James Bond.
James Bond definitely feels like he deserves to be in every room doing everything.
The other day I watched A Quantum of Solace, like kind of at random. I don't know why, like Sean wasn't home and Frank was in his room or something. So I had the living room to myself for once and I'm just like browsing around on Netflix. And one of my favorite moments in that movie is when he seduces the like redhead from MI6 that's supposed to collect him or whatever. And they just walk into the hotel suite that they have. And he goes into the bedroom and starts to take off his shirt and then looks back at her and says, I can't find the stationery. Come help me look for it. It's like the lamest come on. And he knows it, but he also knows that he doesn't have to try. Like, I'm giving you the barest excuse to come into the bedroom with me. And that's all it's going to take.
Yeah, that's fantastic. The thing that I always hear new artists or inexperienced artists talking about is, how do I know I have a good idea? I'm not confident in my ideas. Should I make this? And I think there's only one answer to should I make this or any variation on that, which is yes, or you'll never make anything.
Yeah, your baby ideas are very vulnerable. And you really can only make the things that you yourself are hyped to make, even if they seem stupid to you. Mm-hmm. Like, I think every book that I have ever made, probably there's some part of me that was like, this is stupid. I shouldn't show this to people. But that feeling gets less and less because even though I have it every time, then I publish it and people are like, they relate to it. They think it's beautiful. They see something in it. And that's why I ended up making comics, is because people responded to my comics that way in a they had never really responded to the fine art that I had been doing in that same way. People liked it, but they didn't feel that kind of intimate connection with it.
Yeah, that's that was a big part of why I became a movie critic, is that people really reacted to my writing about film and television.
Yeah, you have good takes.
Thank you. So long story short, you just have to do it, and you have to do it until it feels less awful.
You have to make what your muse or whatever you want to call it is telling you to make, and then you have to share it with people and they'll get excited about it or they won't. They probably will, but if they don't, you just have to keep making stuff. There's no amount of acclaim that will make you know for sure that you're good at what you do. You really just have to find the thing that you enjoy making. You have to find where's the intersection between the thing that you love to make and the thing that hits where people are going to pay you to make it.
Yes. And that's if you want commercial success.
Yeah, actually, I want to talk about that because yesterday on Twitter, there was some guy who replied to a retweet that I did. And
oh my God.
It was about how artists deserve to be paid a living wage, pretty unobjectionable stuff. And he was like, artists deserve what they earn, just like everybody else. And they have to make work that people are willing to give them money for, or else they don't deserve to make a living wage. And like, I was just like, this is stupid. You're stupid. This is not a statement that merits serious engagement.
Right.
Art is not a practice that will ever generate money commensurate with its value.
God, no.
That's just not how it works. And if you're able to do art that is both valuable and remunerative, then that's great and very lucky. But you can't know how good your art is by how much people are willing to pay for it. And you can't... Where was I going with this sentence? Hang on. I started pulling on a piece of tape and then my head just went blank because the tape was so satisfying.
Love a good sensory adventure.
Oftentimes, if you're making art that is really necessary in the world, you're not going to get paid a lot for it because most of the people who need art are broke.
Right.
The rich people have the entire culture reflecting themselves back at them. And they have work that they can fund that shows them what they want to see. The rest of us, the more we talk about our own realities, the more we appeal to strictly other people like us who don't have money.
There was this great article that went around, I think, months ago, and it revealed a large, sweeping moderation practice at TikTok, which is that they were selectively blacklisting videos that they thought might go viral from the algorithm. What? And the criteria that they used to select those videos was that if they featured a poor person, poor looking person, or someone who they considered ugly. Because they didn't want those to become defining images of TikTok. And the criteria if you're ugly included like fatness, disability, just it was hellish.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pop culture. I mean that same process occurs in almost all film and we're all fine with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're allowed to see in mainstream culture only a very, very narrow slice of the population that doesn't reflect reality. And right.
White, thin, able, symmetrical people who do not
upper middle class.
Yeah.
At least. And often rich. And the more that you can disengage with that culture, it's just better. It's better for your brain if you don't trick yourself into believing that the only people who exist, the only people who matter, are skinny, blonde, 25-year-olds.
Right. It's like as people who are in recovery from eating disorders, you and I should not be spending our time following the exploits of models.
Mm-hmm.
Because it corrodes your brain.
If I'm like shopping online at like a plus size store, and then like if I go back to like straight sizes website, then it's like, oh my God, all these people are dying. It's horrifying. And you just like, it's just the water that you swim in. You don't even notice it. And you get a very warped idea of what people deserve to be looked at.
Yeah, you do. And even all moral and ethical considerations aside, it is boring.
Yes.
It inspires no strong feelings. It's just anodyne. It's nothing. You know, this is something you told me, but real beauty is something that you could just as easily look at and say, like, my God, that's hideous.
Yes.
It's something that gets at something deep inside you and just squeezes.
Yes, beauty is terrifying.
Right.
Beauty is
compulsion.
Do you remember when I said I wanted to write a story about the most beautiful woman in the world who had only one hair and one tooth?
Yes.
I still think about that. We were talking about Helen of Troy because people kept casting like beautiful actresses. And it's like, well, first of all, all actresses look the same.
Yes.
I remember on the His Dark Materials Reddit when the show first started airing and they were like, so many people were like, well, who's more beautiful, Nicole Kidman or Ruth Wilson? And I was like, they're two of the most beautiful women in the world. Like, why do we have to have this conversation? It's stupid and it's pointless. Neither of them look like real people.
Right, and it's demeaning.
Mm-hmm.
Although I do think constantly, I can never fucking unthink this about how you told me that Ruth Wilson looks like the professor from The Nightmare Before Christmas.
Yeah, Dr. Finkelstein. No, she totally does.
Right, she has that same mouth. It's just, once you see it, you'll never be able to unsee it.
Yes, no, me too. I mean, first of all, I would die for her, but also, yeah, she looks like Dr. Finkelstein. Like a very, very beautiful Dr. Finkelstein.
Yeah, just if,
look him up, you'll see it.
Yeah, put him side by side. Unmissable.
Personally, I like her better because she's a little weird looking.
Exactly. I mean, she
because
has
there's
like,
no beauty without some strangeness in the proportion.
Right.
Like Alan Poe said that.
To go back to Helen of Troy, she's so commonly referred to as the face that launched 1,000 ships. And the idea that someone could do that and also be palatable to like the LL Bean summer catalog is insane.
Stupid.
She looked like a freak.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she like had some gigantic nose and crazy eyebrows or something. Like, this is
and
not
like eyes on the side of her head like a deer.
Right. This is not some woman that you could walk out into the street and be like, well, she could be any of them, I guess.
No. Yeah. She's person who is so singular that nobody else will do.
There's
you can't stop thinking about.
There's a line in The Neon Demon, which is a silly movie that I really like, about beauty and how beauty is manufactured and sold and evaluated and sort of instilled in people. And there's this scene where a photographer is discussing different models and he makes one stand up. And he forces this man to describe her to her face. And the guy doesn't want to do it. And finally, he just mumbles, she's fine. And the photographer snaps his fingers and says, yes, that's precisely it. She's fine. And that's what I always think of when I see inoffensively beautiful people.
Mm-hmm.
Just like, that's fine. I don't understand why you want me to look at it. It's Muzak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Challenge me.
Exactly.
Okay, let's do one more question.
Sounds good. What works of horror in literature or comics are criminally underread and underrated?
Oh, I don't know.
Well, there's a second part to this. This one will be more fun. In addition, if you could erase one film property from existence, which would it be and why?
Huh. A film property would be like a series or...
Yeah, I think it could be sort of like a series or just a movie or... maybe a director for the sake of argument.
Well, first of all, when I don't like something or I'm not interested in it, I don't pay attention to it. So if there is a film property that is not worth my time, I probably am not aware of it or not conscious of how popular it is. My brain is a sacred space. I don't let just anything into it.
There's definitely a lot more mud packed into mine when it comes to movies.
Yeah. You have a much more promiscuous palate than I do.
It's a more choleric temperament about it. When something offends me creatively, I do tend to get mad about it. Like the mediocrity of the Marvel movies as a mission statement is very offensive to me.
Mm.
But there's really only one movie that I think I would erase from existence if I had the power to do so. And that is Requiem for a Dream by Darren Aronofsky.
Oh, wow.
I would not erase his whole filmography because he's, even if he is a boring, hateful idiot, he did make The Fountain, which I love. But Requiem for a Dream is just a movie about how addicts are terrible and subhuman. Mm-hmm. And I can't think of anything less necessary than that.
Yeah.
I hate it. It makes me feel sick to my stomach in a completely unproductive way. And if you but handed me the match, I would flick it onto the pile of old-timey film reels and just torch it out of existence.
See, I know I've seen Requiem for a Dream, but I just reformatted that part of my brain and put something else in it.
Good.
Yeah.
It brings me no joy to be angry about it.
None? It's kind of fun to be angry.
I mean, I do like to be angry, but I like to be angry at things that are are stupid and absurd. And I think that Requiem for a Dream is hateful and destructive. I hate it in the same way that, like, I hate people who pass anti-trans laws. Like, there's no joy in that rage.
Yeah.
It's someone looking at vulnerable people and deciding what we really need to do here is, like, enact judgment on these disgusting subhumans.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, what was the first part of the question?
The first part of the question was, what works of horror in literature or comics are criminally underread and underrated? This is, like, not something that is super on the forefront of my mind often.
How do you know if something is underrated?
Oh, you know what? I actually do have something to plug here.
Right.
I love Melanie Temm, who was, like, an 80s paperback queen who has sort of faded from the general consciousness of horror fiction. But she wrote a really incredible werewolf novel called Wilding, which is about, I think, three or four generations of this matrilineal werewolf family. It's so slimy and dysfunctional and sad and small. There's no fate of the world shit. There are no larger ramifications to these people living their lives. It's just, like, dysfunction in this monstrous family. I love it so much.
Okay, good answer.
Thank you.
I got nothing. I don't know.
All right.
I don't like getting recommendations, as you know, and I don't do a lot of recommending things to other people. I kind of like to keep my faves to myself. Mm-hmm. That's that bad indie music hipster instinct.
Well, I mean, as another person who despises getting recommendations, I don't think there's really anything wrong with that.
Well, I know you wouldn't think so. Maybe validating me.
Maybe we're not the best sample group.
We're just like any aspect of human behavior, like, man, when people, like, they have some gum and then they, like, fold the wrapper into a little square instead of wadding it up. Like, can you believe that? Like, the other one of us is going to be, like, this fucked up, this fucking deranged that somebody would do this shit.
That's very true.
I'm Jesus disgusted. Christ. I'm appalled. My day is ruined.
Right. Real zero to bitch eating crackers.
Yes. Let me tell you something about those bitches eating crackers. Nobody should eat crackers around me.
Ugh, the sound of chewing. Intolerable.
Awful. Ugh. If I could wish something totally selfish and petty, it would probably be that I could tolerate the sound of people chewing around me. It really makes my life harder.
Yeah, it's a difficult thing. Especially because it gives you, like, negative feelings about people you love who aren't doing anything wrong.
Yes.
And because it's painful and difficult to endure.
Mm-hmm.
Ugh, sound shit.
I love to be mad. I love to be intolerant. But I would like to be intolerant about actually hateful things and not totally harmless human behavior.
Yeah, shit that matters.
But that is not the hand that I was dealt. So shall we say goodnight?
I think that sounds like a good note to go out on.
Okay. Thank you, Gretchen, for recording another podcast with me.
Thank you for recording one with me, Juj.
You've been listening to The Lament Configuration. You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, a lot of other things, SoundCloud at anchor.fm/lament-configuration. Add us on Twitter if you have questions you want us to answer, or if you would like to join our Discord, such as it is. Good night.